A very good day to all. Welcome to Drop by Drop, the podcast where we explore the diverse and captivating world of water, one drop at a time. This is your host, James, and with each episode, we'll dive deep into the fascinating and crucial aspects of this beautiful, essential blue resource, which is the lifeblood of our planet, vital for all forms of life. It nourishes us, sustains our communities, and powers our economies. Yet, despite its fundamental importance, water is facing unprecedented challenges today. Climate change, pollution, and overuse are threatening this precious resource, making it more critical than ever to understand and discuss these issues. From pioneering technology in water purification and conservation, to the profound importance of climate change on our water supplies, we'll engage with experts, community leaders, and everyday heroes who are making waves in this field. Whether you are an environmental enthusiast or simply curious about the water you drink, DBD might have something for you. Join us as we uncover the hidden depths of the water world, celebrating advancements and tackling the challenges that affect us all. So feel free to pour yourself a refreshing glass of water, sit back, and let's begin this journey together. This is Drop by Drop, and your host, James Joseph. Once again, welcome to the very first episode of Drop by Drop. After a very long cycle of procrastinating, overthinking, and many cups of coffee, I'm thrilled to finally bring you this special episode. The kick of accomplishment feels fantastic, but what makes this debut truly special is a topic we are diving into, and the incredible person on the other side of the mic. Today, in this first episode, I would like to take you into a conversation about the urgent issue of PFAS contamination of water. For those of you familiar with PFAS, you know the gravity of the issue, right? For those who aren't, let me give you a quick introduction. Per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances are synthetic chemicals found in a wide range of products from firefighting foams to non-stick cookware. They have been linked to serious health concerns and are known for their persistence in the environment and the human body, earning them the nickname forever chemicals. The contamination of our drinking water, surface water, even with small amounts of PFAS, can lead to huge impacts, to huge deterioration of our human health. This contamination is a critical issue that governments, industries, utilities, and water professionals across the globe are grappling with. To talk about this special topic, indeed, we need somebody who has immense experience in the water industry. I am incredibly excited about today's conversation because we have a very special guest with us. And today, on the other side of the mic, I have Sally Gutierrez. Sally is a renowned environmental scientist and a leading advocate for water quality. She has dedicated over 2 decades to researching and addressing water contaminants, including significant work with US Environmental Protection Agency, where she played a crucial role in developing regulations and strategies to safeguard our water. Sally, welcome to the show. Before we dive into the details of PFAS contamination, I would love to start with a more personal question. What was your ikigai moment? That defining instant when you knew you were meant to dedicate your life for water research?
No, I appreciate the question very much and this opportunity to be part of your podcast endeavor. Water is something that is very, very near and dear to my heart, because I care about very much individual people, especially poor communities and people that may not have a lot of resources, may not even have internet service, right? So very early in my career, I confronted a situation that was along the Texas-Mexico border. And developers were building subdivisions along the border, hundreds of these subdivisions. And the subdivisions did not have water and wastewater provisioning. Mm-hmm. They would build these houses and these communities, but did not even provide that.
Basic
needs for sanitation and safe drinking water. So I personally went to see some of these communities then, and I saw people that were getting water out of agricultural irrigation ditches.
Okay.
So they would collect the water, and that's the water that they were using
for
drinking water, for cooking, and other. And for me, it was very personal because, you know, my parents came from Mexico. Mm-hmm. So these were primarily people living at the Texas-Mexico border, and most of them were immigrants from Mexico to the United States. So to me, it was a very, very personal, how could these developers have been allowed to create these communities in that way? And the outcome of that was quite startling in terms of the number of disease cases. Mm-hmm. I worked for the Department of Health at the time.
And you're talking about how many years back?
Yeah, so this was 30 years ago. And probably beyond that. But I was just really taken, and I made it then my life's mission to try and prevent that from happening ever again. One of the other issues that was entangled in that whole thing was the border had the highest levels of anencephalic birth. Mm-hmm. So these were children that were born to mothers there that had open spines, open brains, and it was the highest levels in the whole country. And so to me, when I looked at all of these things together, it was my first exposure to what was environmental injustice, right?
Exactly.
Environmental injustice. So I really tried to do everything that I could to influence that, and some progress was made. But to me, it made me who I am today, and very, very much an advocate for safe water and sanitation for everyone.
It's indeed inspiring to hear your story and learn about that pivotal moment that gave you the purpose and energy to work relentlessly to safeguard the common man's right to access safe water. Personally, I too believe that finding one's ikigai can bring meaning and direction to our lives and to our career. Since today's focus is on PFAS, I would love to know, when did you first encounter PFAS contamination of water in your work? When did you and PFAS cross paths?
PFAS is one of those issues that is not new in terms of, we knew it was present in human blood for a long time. Yeah. We knew that for
more
a very long time. Yeah. But it's interesting that only now has EPA taken steps to impose limits, and first and foremost in drinking water. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be, I think, extremely challenging for those water utilities, public drinking water facilities, that are going to have to come into compliance with these very, very low levels of these PFAS chemicals. It doesn't regulate all the PFAS chemicals, so we're still gathering, the agency is still gathering information on other versions of the PFAS chemicals. But the one thing that we do know is that these chemicals do cause cancer. They do cause adverse health effects when people are exposed to them.
It accumulates in your body.
Absolutely. And so there is a clear health risk that is associated with ingestion and, you know, just absorption of these chemicals in the body. But sadly, it took us a long time. It took the agency, not us, it took the agency a long time to do that.
But in the US, awareness of PFAS issue is growing, and the general public is well aware of this situation that they have to tackle in their drinking water. Similarly, in the European Union as well, this topic is gaining a lot of attention recently. And recently in the Belgian newspapers, we had headlines that revealed ministers detected PFAS in their blood, highlighting the issue's urgency. On the other side, we have countries like India, where I come from. PFAS still remains unregulated, as I know, and the public awareness is quite minimal. In European Union, if we speak of the regulations, we follow some PFAS limit, some PFAS 20 limits, and total PFAS limits, whereas US EPA has come up with a bold move with an ambitious safe limit of 4 ppt in drinking water. So when we look generally, we have countries with clear limits, clear targets for PFAS in their drinking water. We have countries with evolving regulations. Given this regulatory uncertainty, how can technology providers and utilities prepare themselves to make their solutions future-proof?
For some, it's probably going to be easier than others, but I'm a strong believer that knowledge is power. So the utilities should try and determine if it is present in the water and at what levels, which PFAS are there, and, you know, what are the measured levels in there. Now, if the systems, for example, some of the systems may already have treatment ion exchange, granular activated carbon.
Yes.
And to me, those utilities are ahead of the game because they've already taken steps that maybe unknowingly they're controlling it, right? They're controlling it in the mm-hmm. drinking water before it gets out to the consumer. If they don't have these treatment systems, then by measuring it, they can inform their customers about what is in the water.
Mm-hmm.
See, in the United States, utilities are required to send out information under the Consumer Confidence Report. So there's an actual report that is required to be shared with the public on what is in the water. And it's really about the regulated contaminants, right, in drinking water. But now the utilities in Europe and elsewhere, by sharing this knowledge, it will at least inform the public. And then the public, they could get point of use devices, they could get other devices
like
that, or they could have simply, you know, pitchers of water that go through a carbon type of filter. So there are ways that the public could prepare, so to speak, in the interim while the policies are being developed and issued.
Yeah, that's true for utilities and end users, but for industry partners who are scouting for next generation treatment methods, who are aiming for a transition from ion exchange, activated carbon, and incineration based solutions to a solution that can completely destroy PFAS. Well, the above-mentioned technologies, they often tend to reintroduce PFAS back into the environment. To solve this issue, we have a handful of next-generation treatment methods, new technologies that claim to completely destroy all types of PFAS. But our understanding of their full capabilities still remains limited. For those searching for effective PFAS destruction technologies, how should they strategize their approach to ensure that they choose reliable and sustainable solution, which is also future-proof?
So I think you've hit upon a very important point, and that is, you know, we have the granular activated carbon, we have the ion exchange and other, you know, technologies that are already deployed at the full scale, and we have a lot of data with regard to the performance of those technologies. The next generation of technologies that need to be brought to scale are exactly what you say. The ones that concentrate it and make it, you know, like this big. So that it can be destroyed efficiently and effectively, right? So I think that those technologies are emerging, right? A lot of them are in research still. Some of them may be at the pilot stage. So to me, it's important to kind of understand the research landscape, right? And figure out where are these emerging technologies in their development at this point, but they are not available for full scale, you know, deployment at this moment. I think there is a wait and see kind of thing. And it could take a number of years to get them to the full scale. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But, you know, you can create a list of those to watch, those that show the most promise, and track those through time. But they are not available. And I guess to me, that's the promise that maybe at some point we get away from GAC altogether or ion exchange and go to these alternative technologies. But it is going to, unless we can get the economics right, because if you've got a water system that's building, you know, the GAC, the granular activated carbon tanks right now, I'm sure they're not going to want to totally abandon those after they've put in all the money to then go to an alternative technology that is maybe 10 years in the future.
Yeah.
I've seen that before, but I think that systems will default to that. But, you know, I do not think that the technologies like granular activated carbon and ion exchange are the solution here, because as you say, we're just taking them from one compartment to another.
The compartment, escaping the problem.
Exactly.
And for these new technologies, do you think energy consumption would be a bottleneck to handle? And also, I would like to know what your opinion is on
whether there would be a clear market dominant destruction technology for PFAS in the future, because we see that there are a lot of technologies, a lot of companies coming up with their proof of concept, and everybody is trying to make a lead in the market. How do you see it? Do you think that in the next few years there would be a clear winner for PFAS destruction technology, or would it be a combination of existing separation technologies and the upcoming new generation destruction methods?
The ideal technology would, you know, extract it out of a full stream of contaminated water, and would separate it in a way that would be very, very small, so that the volume of what has to be destroyed, that would be extremely small, and that should not take that much energy. Right. Should not. Famous last words. Exactly. Should not do that. But it's not, I don't see a winner per se right now, but I am hopeful about, for example, the BioLargo technology, because I think that they are on the right track in terms of really trying to separate just the PFAS out and really concentrate it. So they're like working on the first step. The destruction is not quite there yet. Mm-hmm, yeah, mm-hmm. It's not quite there, but I do think that they've made good progress in the development of technology that at least will concentrate it. So that's the first step. And then we have to work on that secondary piece. Right, so that at this point, it appears that technology still uses GAC or ion exchange on the tail end, right, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. for that. But, you know, the idea is to concentrate it down. Don't let the volume of that waste be very large. You know, keep it at an absolute minimum and then go from there.
So the technologies for separation is also equally important.
Yeah.
As
oh, yes, very much so, very much so.
And while the entire water industry is running behind PFAS, could it be that there is or there are other contaminants that are hiding right now, or that are unregulated right now, but has the capability to hit the water industry unexpected and surprisingly leaving us all confused and perplexed on how to handle them? What are the chances that we are leaving out or we are missing other potential contaminants while we are fighting for PFAS? I mean, fighting against PFAS.
So from the chemical side, I think there will always be a need to determine what's in the water and what's that composition. It's a complex process like everything else, because before you can say, even take it into determining if there's a health risk, right? You have to have analytical methods, right?
Yeah,
you have
true.
To have published analytical methods. You have to create a data set that says how wide is this contamination, because if you find a contaminant and it's only found in one water system across the country, there's no need for regulation at the national level. So you have to have very, very solid occurrence data, right? And then you have to do an assessment of the health risks related. If you find something, then you have to know what the health risks are. And then you have to have a determination, will the establishment of a limit in drinking water, for example, buy you the health benefits, right? And then you go through a whole process to determine what are the available technologies and the like. And then you have to conduct an economic analysis that will tell you, is it going to be affordable to add additional treatment if there's more treatment that is needed? what is that cost that's attributed? Because I always make this comment about arsenic. When EPA lowered the arsenic standard, the levels that were associated with the adverse health effects, right, were lower than where the agency set the MCL, right? And the reasoning was that if there was, number one, there weren't technologies at that time that bring it down. And then the issue of how much it would cost the consumers to pay for that was also a big issue. So it's a regulation that has to make sense on so many levels, and there have to be so many analyses and so many data sets that have to be considered before there is an affirmative move like we've had with PFAS, with the PFAS that we're regulating now, that EPA is regulating now. So it's not easy. Could there be other contaminants? And I'll give you an example of one contaminant, Legionella. Now that's a microbial contaminant, but Legionella can be found at the end of distribution systems, showers, right?
Yeah.
And it's caused because of stagnant water that loses the disinfection, and that people can be exposed to that. And they can die. They can die. I mean, there's a clear public health, you know, issue there. But the EPA has determined that it does not have the authority to regulate contaminants at the end of the distribution system. Most of the regulations are at the point of entry.
Yes.
Into the distribution system, not at the end of it. And then there are considerations around how long does the water sit. Mm-hmm. So there'll be different levels of risk, you know. So it's very complicated. But Legionella is an example of a contaminant that can kill someone, right? But yet the agency will probably never promulgate an MCL.
But for Legionella, how hard is it to eradicate this problem?
So to me, it's all about, you know, keeping the residual of this disinfectant and flushing. The chemical ones are very difficult. The EPA is always looking for contaminants and considering contaminants for future regulation. There's some process that's in place to look at a set of chemicals and microbial contaminants, you know, through the contaminant candidate list. There's a process to determine which ones would be monitored for, and then ensues, you know.
And is this process open to? Can public access or
absolutely?
And so they can keep track on what EPA is keeping track.
Yes, very much so, and. The good part is that the public can participate, can provide their recommendations and their views on what contaminants should be looked at next. So there is a process where they'll take public comment on that.
Very interesting.
So it's not at all a closed box, but more open, I think, than it's ever been.
Interesting. It's already 37, 38 minutes, and I have one last question, one final question before I thank you for this wonderful opportunity. What is your message to young water professionals who are waiting to enter this fantastic field of work?
So to me, the water field is unlike any other field, and that's a broad statement because it could be a young professional that wants to work manually turning valves or going down manholes or these sorts of things. So it could be that kind of person, or it could be a data analyst that is working with data at water systems for processing, or it could be policymakers. It could be just this broad range.
Or marketeers.
Yeah, marketers, communicators. So there is such an opportunity in water. And I think for young people, it's like, it's a profession where your work can make a difference in the quality of life for individual people.
Across the globe.
Across the globe. Yes. And it is something that, from my view, is just personally and professionally very rewarding. And I would encourage anyone to study hard, but you know, in this range of professions, it doesn't mean that you have to have an engineering degree in civil engineering or, you know, this sort of thing. It's a very, very broad field. And, you know, water operators get certified, you know, as water operators and different grades and things like that. But there are just so many different ways that you can contribute to the water industry, and it's just, for me, it has been such an amazing career, right, in water, from a policy and regulatory point of view, a research point of view, but there'll never be any regrets in my view working in the water field. And the field is always changing and evolving, so it's not something that you're going to be turning valves for 30 years or something,
or
you know.
You're not going to be treating PFAS all the time.
I mean, yes,
water
industry, exactly.
It's not just water treatment. You have
exactly.
agriculture, you have AI penetrating
exactly,
water
exactly.
You have diverse fields to enjoy
absolutely.
And carry on.
Absolutely.
Oh, that's really insightful, and I thank you so much for this wonderful opportunity. I hope that our conversation would be of interest to many people out
yes.
there. And thank you so much.
All right.
Have a
thank
wonderful
you.
Flight back to US.
Okay.
I hope you enjoyed this forum.
Oh, absolutely. All right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sally. All right.
And that's the time to wrap up the first episode of Drop by Drop, the Water Podcast. I hope this wonderful episode featuring Sally talking about PFAS contamination of water was quite interesting to all of you. I would love to hear your feedback and possible topics which you would like to be featured on this podcast. Feel free to write to me, and until we see you next time, bye-bye.